Welcome to the Nerds Podcast, number 426. What happened to the music? Skydart wanted to make royalty-free music with mouth beats.
It always cuts out.
The day is here. At midnight on Comedy Central, my new late night show is starting tonight at midnight. Technically, it's Tuesday morning, but we're going to call midnight Monday night. Let's say it starts at 11:59 and 59 seconds. It's on after Colbert 4 nights a week. They're giving us a month, so please watch it. It's a kind of a stand-up comedy game show in the sense that it's really just an excuse to get a bunch of comics to come together and screw around and make jokes about stuff we pulled from social media. But it'll look like a game show, but it's really a bunch of comics dicking around. And our first episode is Doug Benson, Camille Nanjiani, Natasha Leggero, and some other people you'll see in the upcoming episodes will be Patton Oswalt and Ron Funches and Kurt Brownoler and Rob Delaney and June Diane Raphael. So it's a pretty spectacular group of comics and performers. So tune in at midnight, Monday through Thursday, after Colbert on Comedy Central, with me, Chris Hardwick, who is also thanking Stamps.com for sponsoring this episode of the Nerdist Podcast. Holidays are coming up, as you may or may not be aware. Christmas junk's going to be going up soon, because Halloween, and then right after Halloween, what happens? And they start putting all the friggin' turkey stuff in the grocery store, and then that's not even done, it's Christmas trees. And so you're going to be mailing a lot of stuff in the coming months. Stamps.com has the entire post office at your fingertips without the post office that surrounds the rest of your body, which is an air of misery. So why do that to yourself? Print out exactly the postage you need with Stamps.com. They're going to send you a digital scale. I mean, you can use the promo code Nerdist. You get the special offer of the digital scale and up to $55 of free postage. It's a $110 bonus offer. It's a no-risk trial. So don't wait. Go to Stamps.com before you do anything else. Click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in Nerdist. That's Stamps.com. Use the promo code Nerdist. This episode is our dear, dear, dear old friend, Greg Proops, Mr. Gregory Proops, who has a new stand-up special available on chill.com starting October 22nd. So today's the Monday we're putting this up, so Tuesday it'll go up. So Greg is one of our favorite performers and a shit ton of a nice guy. So please get Greg's special and check out this podcast you're about to check out. Why did the music drop out? Because that's music where I would use the term check out, as if I were a DJ doing a chill out mix.
The beat's about to drop.
Oh, wait, let me light the Nag Champa incense and then try to get in your pants to that chill out mix. Here's Greg Proops on Nerds Podcast episode number 426.
I'm the worst beatboxer.
Can I still get in your pants?
We'll see.
Gonna beat your box.
End that shit. End it now.
What?
End it now.
I don't really want to beat it.
You want to beat my box? What is that joke?
I don't know.
It's the worst thing ever.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Blackberry in the United States.
Yeah. Steam powered, man. You put the water right in.
That's why you went to Niagara Falls to charge up your phone.
I'm don't know what I'm waiting for. I'll get a smartphone.
I love that we were just talking about how you were in Niagara Falls and you got back from Niagara Falls. And then Katie brought up that the people who, for some reason or other, who are like, oh, we should go over this in a barrel. And that instantly just sparked the anxiety of, I cannot imagine a worse thing than to basically seal yourself into a fucking barrel and go over a waterfall.
The terror of going off an enormous precipice with millions of cubic gallons of water has to be exacerbated by being in a hideous black hole that you have no control over.
Just being in a barrel sends me into a panic.
Just gross. If we were just in this room over there.
And don't worry, we're not going to touch it. I don't give a shit. Yeah. I'm in that barrel.
This is someone to be in it.
I don't want to be in a barrel ever, really. Not even if I'm an apple. Or beer. I don't.
Yeah. Or many monkeys.
Or a bunch of fish.
Well... It's easy to get the monkeys out of the barrel. You just have to hook their arms, and then they pull out one at a time. That's how monkeys work.
That's how monkeys work.
Yeah, that's exactly how.
Yeah, they do, right? They link when you pull them out.
Yeah, that's just part of their...
Sometimes they're yellow. Yeah. Blue and whatnot.
I'll tell you, it really is not fun.
It's not fun. But Niagara Falls was...
Well, we were there doing a gig, and the gig was fine. It was at some theater, but people acted like it was a casino because we actually got a big enough round of applause to do an encore, and I'm not one to sniff at an encore. If everyone's standing, you know, you can't make an audience stand. They don't stand just because you say stand. And boom, they opened the doors, and everyone left. And we were like almost embarrassingly walking back out. You know, oh, you love us, and then you're gone.
Oh, we just came out to wave goodbye.
Yeah. So our tour manager went over and went, "What the fuck? You know, keep the doors closed. Keep the house lights down for a second. Can't you see that everyone's standing?" And they're like, "Oh, well, show's over." You're like, oh, brother.
Oh, they understand waterfall philosophy, so it's like they have to keep the flow.
Yeah, that was what it was.
Been backed up too long, you know. Yeah. If we get these people, this could blow up.
Get in your barrel and go home.
one guy just crowd surfing through the barrel.
Yeah. Waterfall culture is so weird.
It's very so weird.
Yeah. So specific.
Yeah. Super iffy. It's misty, for one thing.
It's going on and on.
And it only goes in one direction. One direction!
Uh-oh.
Waterfall.
They're like a waterfall. But you know what? Don't go chasing waterfalls. Oh my God, Riff Fest.
Chasing waterfalls. Which takes you to the Housewives of Atlanta, because she's on the show.
What?
The woman who wrote Waterfalls was one of the characters on the show. I can't remember her name. She's a sad songwriter on the show.
Her name is Claire Waterfall.
Exactly.
Now, when you say sad songwriter, do you mean sad songwriter or like she's a sad songwriter? I mean,
she's a sad, comma, songwriter.
Okay, there it is, yeah.
Or sad, semicolon, songwriter.
She's a bit of a sad.
I mean, why would you be on the Housewives of Atlanta? You know, it's like... Because you're desperate for attention or whatever.
No, you have a story that needs to be told, and it's the only avenue.
And every housewife in Atlanta.
They really do. Yeah. Whether they're rich or semi-bankrupt. It seems like that was what the story was. But I don't know why I know that. Oh, because she's on the show. She talks about it. She wrote that horrible song for Kim, what's her name, the blonde lady who was on the show, called Don't Be Tardy for the Party. Which, oh, yeah. Oh, yes,
what
she
show?
Did. It's called The Housewives of Atlanta. It was on Bravo. Yes, I've watched it. I'm not a regular viewer as much anymore because I find that a philately takes up a good deal of my time.
Of course, yes. That would take a lot of time.
And the study of waterfalls. Which
yes,
is,
of course.
Putting all the little in place.
Yeah.
It takes a lot of time.
Yeah, they do.
But don't be tardy for the party. And I feel like a lot of people, it's accepted that we're tardy for parties. And so, you know, if you really strip away all the layers on top of all the detritus, I think underneath you'll find really a special message that we can all use.
Well, an erroneous message, as you point out. Who wants someone to show up early to the party?
You know who shows up early to parties?
Yet.
It's people with low self-esteem.
Yeah.
Or it's people like me who don't want to stay too late and then want to leave before a lot of people show up.
That's true.
Or your best friend who's just there when it starts anyway.
Yeah, he's helping.
Yeah.
He's helping out.
I brought chips. Well, I brought some chips that I had in a bag. I didn't buy a new one.
No, I gotta go.
And here's a napkin.
Yeah. Hey, happy Columbus Day, you guys.
Oh, finally.
We're recording this on Columbus Day.
We can finally let loose.
How are you observing the Columbus Day holiday?
There were some Native Americans in my neighborhood who I cut their arms off because they didn't give me enough gold. Uh-huh. I thought that would be the best way to do it.
Yeah.
The way Columbus did it.
That's right.
Also, I moved into the house next door, and I said, this is my house now because God is on my side, and the King of Spain has allowed me to do this.
Well, mm-hmm. I went into the valley and wrongly named it Century City. So a lot of different ways that you could...
There really is. Columbus Day, that has to be the holiday that's changed the most since we were little, because it went from being we used to draw pictures of it and read about him when I was a little kid, and then it went to, don't mention Columbus's name, because in San Francisco, too, they used to have a guy would dress up like Columbus and land near the Golden Gate Bridge in the marina and walk on the shore in a little boat and pretend to be planting a flag and what.
How quick would he start murdering people?
Well, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, because the main drag in San Francisco is Columbus, right, that goes through North Beach. Corso Cristoforo Colombo, right, because he's from Genoa. And so they were very proud of him for being Italian. And so now they're controversy because it's San Francisco, so we can't be uncool
right.
and let someone who started the genocide be a hero. But at the same time, there's enough Italians that are like, well, he's from Italy. That's cool, right?
It's so funny. San Francisco, it's like so trying hard not to step on yeah. toes that they even, you know, it's like where does it end?
Everyone's crying.
Yeah.
There's too many agendas.
I love the idea that there are still those creepy 70s strip clubs.
Yeah.
In North Beach.
Yeah. Well, yes. It feels like that's the thing, that whole area in North Beach, because I was just there last or two nights ago.
Yeah, I was there a couple yeah. weeks ago at Cubs. Yeah. You were at Punchline.
Yeah, and then it's just like it feels, it's the only city that it like feels, this is like, it still has a little bit of the Old West feel to it.
Oh, yeah.
This guy's going, come on in, see tits. Like,
the
it just
the
feels,
Roaring 20, the Garden of Allah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Really.
Well, there is that sort of.
There used to be a dude who stood in front of that with a fez, like Morocco Mole. He was a big fat guy. He worked there for 25 years.
Morocco oh, my God.
Yeah, you know, he wore a little fez. And, all right, gentlemen, come inside, please. Please. The show has started already.
Secret.
Yeah, Secret Square.
Secret Square.
I love that there's and then parts of San Francisco, though they've shed most of it. But the gold rush era, yeah, you know, yeah. like the Barbary Coast kind of yeah. thing.
Come on down and get Mickey'd and be sent to Shanghai.
Yeah,
to
yeah exactly.
Be part of the white slavery. Yeah. Evidently, San Francisco, I think, was the most licentious and wide open horror up until the 20th century. Apparently, there was underground tunnels all through Chinatown. The opium trade there was extraordinary, and the cops were always involved in it. And, it was supposed to be just like – the danger of going to those waterfront bars 100 years ago, you would definitely get knocked out if you were a rube and fucking sent to China. You know what I mean? Yeah. Or wherever.
Yeah.
The next thing you know, you wake up and you're in a barrel. And
there was a lot. That was all up and down the West Coast. They were doing that a lot in Seattle, I think, too. And,
absolutely.
And my friend was – I was just telling my friend up in San Francisco. He said he's in a band. He played some kind of like – basement show in Chinatown, and he was like looking around. He's like, "Oh, this was probably where they would like bring people down temporarily until they uh-huh. There was like he saw like a tunnel going out, and he's like, "Oh, this is probably where they did it."
Yep.
It was like a bar upstairs, and then fucking downstairs they bring him down, send him out.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we may have a lot of inconvenient trappings of contemporary culture, but at no time do we feel like, oh, if I go to that place, someone's going to knock me out and send me into a right. weird slave trade.
If you go to the Coach and Horses on Sunset, you're not going to get Shanghai.
Not there anymore. Now it's the Pikey.
It's the Pikey. But they have yeah. a drink in memoriam to the Coach and Horses.
Oh, they do?
Yeah, it should have been called the old crone who's never left behind the bar that you drank with for 15 years.
I think we all remember her. Yeah. Too long to fit on a sign.
Yeah. I remember one time at that bar, I was told not to come into the bathroom. I was like, no, I really got to go. Right. And I tried to open the door, and then I saw just like guys like caught in headlights, like dealing cocaine.
Right.
And then I got shoved to the ground.
Oh. What?
Yeah, yeah.
What?
Was there a happy ending to this? Or?
No, I got shoved to the ground, and then I quickly ran away. Yeah. And I was like, I was 20 years old, shouldn't have been there anyway.
The Coach and Horses was, if memory serves, from a long time ago, that was a fine place to go day drinking.
Oh,
oh yeah, it was.
Yeah,
because it was dark inside.
Open, super air conditioned.
It's just there's something about a dirty old pub where you're just like no judgment, like always open, no
drawing
judgment.
Room in Los Feliz is another place where there's just no windows.
I never drank that Far East.
Yeah,
I stayed in Hollywood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's another one of those places. You know, a bar opens at 6 is a place where you know you're not going to get judged. The Roost in Atwater, yeah.
Right, because like bakers are coming in at 6 and going, give me 2 whiskeys, and then going next door and finishing baking or whatever. I was thinking of that other horrible one that's down Sunset, or is it on Hollywood? Cat and the Fiddle?
Cat and Fiddle.
Oh, Cat and Fiddle.
Cat and the Fiddle.
I'm going there tonight.
Oh, there you go.
I like
you really make
Fiddle.
All the hot spots.
The Cat and Fiddle. I like the Cat and Fiddle because it has a nice ambiance there. You got your dartboards. You got an outdoor patio.
The patio is great. Yeah.
If you like English footy, they show English footy.
Yeah. Yeah. They're not afraid.
Oh, no.
Tonight they're showing Ed Wood.
What?
Are they really? That's where you're going there?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I love that movie.
It's my favorite movie of all time.
Is it really?
Yeah,
it's my favorite Tim Burton movie, I think.
Definitely. Oh, yeah,
It's
definitely.
The only one that's like sentimental and coherent and fun. And
yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because all the other ones are,
Well, he's telling a story that of a person that had a life and that he's really interested in. Yeah. That's why. That's like he's telling the story of him almost.
Yeah.
And he likes it. And that's why I also liked Frankenweenie because it was just like – it's like he's kind of like – it's about a kid that was really into horror movies and loves his dog. It's like, oh, this kind of just the
so
story.
So you're saying that you enjoy these films because you feel that they're the most personal, as opposed to, you know, like he's just doing like a Tim Burton stylized thing. That
yeah, I don't think he finds anything like, you know,
Willy Wonka and Planet of the Apes are not.
That was that was first of all a weird movie to put Willy Wonka on the planet. Oh, yeah, you mean the separate movies? I was thinking of his one movie, Willy Wonka and the Planet of the Apes.
You should have done them together with Sweeney Todd and had it be Sweeney Todd on the Planet
Come
of the Apes.
Come with me and you'll see a world of humans taking over.
How do you take the original Willy Wonka, which is hilarious and mordant and trenchant and, you know, caustic, and turn it into a hideous, you know, ride of people in white makeup and hideous? I mean, they're starving in the beginning, and they're really starving. You're like, this isn't making it funny.
Yeah.
was the original Willy Wonka, was it set in Vienna? Where was the, like, the setting was like
the original one was shot in Europe. It wasn't shot in, it was shot in, like, Germany or somewhere.
Because they made it, because it felt like an Austrian city.
Yeah, it did.
But it was, but they were, they all spoke English. Like,
and they were all American. He's American somehow.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. I couldn't, and even, he's American, and his grandparents have not gotten out of bed in, like, 30 years.
Yeah.
And they, so they've been there for a long time.
Well, then they must be from Vienna. Right. I don't know.
Because
when they fly over at the end, you see that it's all red roofs and like everything. No, they shot on location in Europe. I interviewed Gene Wilder once years ago. And I asked him about it. And he was, you know, he was lovely. But he the beginning when he walks in and the cane gets stuck and he flips over, he said that was his idea. He goes, we just started in. He goes, I said to the director, I've got to do something that... the director just passed away this year. Mel Stewart, I think his name was. He made mostly documentaries. To show that the character, whatever he says, is a lie, and that you should never... I want to put the audience off so that they are never, the rest of the movie, trusting what he says. So he came up with the stick gets stuck, and he goes like that, and then he does a flip, and he jumps up, and everybody cheers.
Oh, nice.
And the director went, all right, do it. And he said he did like 15 takes. And then he goes, do it once without it. And he's like, I don't want to do it without it because I know you're going to fucking use that one.
Oh.
And then they did one without it. And he goes, but they came away and they used the one that he picked. So at the end of the interview, I says to Gene Wilder, so this was years ago, and it was one of these airline things for England. Like, when you're in London, come to the West End. Because he was doing a Neil Simon play called Laughter on the 54th Floor.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah. Where he's playing Sid Caesar. And if there was ever an actor who shouldn't have played Sid Caesar, it's Gene Wilder. Sid Caesar in the 50s was 6'4", gigantic. Yeah. He had Mel Brooks out the window. He drank, you know, he was on meth. And Gene Wilder's just this beautiful little, you know. So he punches a wall in one scene in the movie, and there's clearly a tearaway wall. And, you know, you're like, this doesn't quite. So I'm interviewing him backstage, and we talked about Richard Pryor and everything. It was good fun. But then I go, so what's up next, Gene? And he goes, I hope to live. For another day. I'm not counting on it. And I have to turn to the camera and go, so when you're in London, be sure to come to Shaftesbury Avenue.
Is he a dark, sad guy?
He wasn't the happiest. He was making a video for someone else who was quite ill at the time, and I think that's why he agreed to do this. But he took a picture with me, and he was nice as could be and everything. Here's another one, though. They had showed Young Frankenstein two nights before, and in those days there was four channels in England. Four. Now there's five. There was four then, and they were showing it on BBC Two at like midnight, and I stayed up and watched it, right? And I was crying laughing, and he wrote the movie, right, with Mel Brooks. And I go, Young Frankenstein, Gene. And he goes, I was watching it recently, and I thought, recently? You were watching it two fucking nights ago, like the rest of us were. Because everyone in London watched it two nights ago, because it was the only bloody thing on at 12 o'clock at night. And he goes, I think I'm a little one note in it. And I was like, no, you're Gene, you know.
Yeah.
But the note is the right note. Like, you know, it's definitely Mel Brooks' funniest, tightest, well, the producers, but I mean.
Yeah.
The genre parody of the Young Frankenstein is spot on. And
it's great.
Well, I think as far as like quotable movies, like the producers definitely has some.
Oh, my God.
But Young Frankenstein, every scene has something in it that sticks with you.
What knockers. Thank you.
I can't necessarily say the same thing about Sherlock Holmes' smarter brother.
Eek.
But you know what? That's okay.
It is okay.
Everything, I mean, you know, they tried.
Yeah, I know. Everything can't be genius.
I have a feeling that that Gene Wilder was a much different person when he was young, when he was older.
Yeah.
I remember seeing him on Actor's Studio, and this was probably like 12 years ago. And James Lipton said something like, I once heard you say that your idea of a perfect something-something was Chopin playing to, you know, like it was just this really pretentious mashup of things. And then Gene Wilder goes, oh, I was so full of shit. Yeah. Like you could just sort of You know, it just sort of felt like, oh, there was, you know, something had happened, or, well, or maybe it was Gilda. Maybe it was the Gilda.
His mother and his wife both died of cancer, so yeah. I think he had a... Because I said, you're a comedian, and he stopped me and went, I'm not a comedian, I'm an actor. And I was like, sorry, you know, what do you say at that point? It's like, but you're so funny.
No, the point is,
you're doing it now. Your movies are funny.
Yeah.
When he raises his voice, it's the funniest goddamn thing in the 70s.
He has good yell voice.
Yeah, the yell voice is his greatest.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's definitely he's one of those guys that that if he were offered for the podcast, I would absolutely do it, but I'm hesitant to try to make it happen because I'm almost a little afraid.
Right. What if he's not? What if he doesn't want to be funny? What if he doesn't want to be amusing in any way? But then again, he would have a million stories to tell because he worked with every director.
I don't mind if he's not amusing. I just as long as he would be, you know, sometimes with guys look, you know, you have someone like Mel Brooks on, and Mel. He's just alive. Yeah, he just wants, he just has all these great stories, and he knows that he totally gets who he is, and he totally gets that it's fun, and he's still excited about things. And then there are other people who have told the same stories over and over, and they just, there's no, you know, it's so hard to find a way in, and you want to ride that line between, well, I want to try to get different information out of you without you seeing the Matrix code behind that, that they don't feel like, you're trying to be different, you know?
Yeah. So but then they want to tell the same party piece that they've memorized, that they've told on 5,000 things.
Yeah. You
know? And that man was Clark Gable.
Right. But that was the thing about Mel Brooks when we had him on. It was like, I've seen every TV appearance of his. I've, you know, got all the DVDs and videos and over the years. And I heard all the stories he was telling us, most of them I had heard. And he was doing them just verbatim.
Yeah.
And then I think that's coming from a guy that always wanted to be a stand-up performer and wasn't. But he did all these other kind of things. So he has his bits.
Yeah.
And any chance he gets, he fucking performs them.
Stand-up philosopher.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, a bullshit artist.
I saw the 12 chairs at the TCM Film Festival last summer. And it's not funny. It doesn't play. Young Frankenstein plays, the producers plays. I showed Annie Hall a couple months ago. Annie Hall still plays. It really does. A whole crowd in L.A. crying, laughing. And I knew there was a bunch of people who'd never seen it before.
Oh, wow.
And all the L.A. jokes still got laughs.
Yeah.
What does he say? There's no garbage on the streets here. And he goes, no, they turn it into television shows. And the place goes, hey, you know. But 12 Chairs is dreary. And all he could talk about was how cheap it was to shoot in Yugoslavia.
Yeah.
That's what Mel Brooks talked about for 20 minutes. Yeah. And then he fucked off and didn't watch the movie. And I thought, God damn it, if I could make you sit here to watch this unfunny piece of shit that never gets off the fucking ground. Except for Dom DeLuise, who has the only funny part in the movie. He tries to stop. Hey, I don't want to live. I don't want to live. I don't want to live. Takes a knife. Ooh-hoo! You know, and that's ooh-hoo! For a year. Ooh-hoo! But I'm I waited an hour for that.
Yeah. Yeah, that movie. I remember being a kid, trying to be a completist when it came out of Mel Brooks.
You didn't see that one, too.
Yeah, yeah. And then I was searching for it, and it was out of print. It wasn't on VHS at all.
Oh, no.
Yeah, and then finally...
I don't even know what it is now.
It is now because... it's on VHS, but VHSs are out of print.
It's on Laserdisc.
Yeah. But, they finally... I think it was in... Not until, 96, they put out, a Mel Brooks collection. Yeah. And 12 Chairs was on it, and it was the only way... And I had already collected all the other VHSs, but the only way to get 12 Chairs, they weren't selling it separately. You had to get it within... the set. So I had to buy the box set even though I had everything else.
Was it History of the World and stuff?
History of the World was in there. High Anxiety, which is one of my personal favorites.
Yeah, High Anxiety is funny.
Yeah. You can't beat that song.
Yeah, yeah. High Anxiety.
And especially I loved it even more when he explained that song where he's the idea of a guy that shouldn't be able to he's just a doctor, he shouldn't be able to sing that well, and is embarrassed and then quickly just owns it by you wanted to get married this morning and they said it went last, all that stuff.
Yeah.
It's not very good.
It's funny how we think of our culture as we're super evolved, and there's sort of I think in our heads we apply a Moore's law to comedy where I'm it gets better every 18 months and people figure it out. When you look back, we're really just doing the same types of jokes that have been done.
That Looney Tunes did.
Well, yeah, yeah. And then there's a certain level where I think we get away with no, I'm doing it ironically. I'm doing silly humor ironically. But then at a certain point, no, you're just doing it. You know, the jokes are the same.
We're always clowns at the end of the day, no matter how seriously we take ourselves. And I'm as pretentious as they come, but at the end of the day...
talking about Guy from the Smartest Man in the World podcast.
That's a joke.
No,
my
really.
He's doing radio stations when they go, so are you really the smartest man in the world?
Yeah. Well, yeah. Yeah. We've got Jimmy the Dickhead here, yeah. Who is our intern, yeah. And he's going to face off with you in a trivia match. Because right. If you're the smartest man in the world.
Yeah. If the world is this room, then yeah. I am.
Exactly. That's what I always feel like
it's
saying.
Carmody. It's Carmody. Yeah, it's Carmody.
At this FM station in the morning show, yes, I am the smartest man in the world.
I can't tell you how many times people say something like, how could you guys say this on the podcast? I'm like, it's comedy. It's a comedy podcast. Yeah. We're fucking around.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're just being silly. Yeah. It'll take it seriously.
That's always the excuse for everything. Because it is. It's just comedy.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's like, no, like, a comic will always, they won't. Like their impulse is to say the funniest thing they can think of, and it's the second thought is like, how bad will this? It's like they don't think to offend; they think that what would get a laugh.
The problem is that when you're a comedian, everywhere is essentially a comedy show, but no one told the rest of the world.
So
it's like you in your head. You're on a comedy show always, but the internet's like, no one told us this was a comedy show. And so you sort of get they treat you like you're in a lecture series.
Yeah. You know? Oh, I know. I do my show live, and I always, before I start, always say, this is a comedy show. So if you feel like laughing, that'd be real encouraging. So that they don't just sit there like this, you know, because you get to play some places are shy or whatever.
Yeah. I put it on the audience where I say like, hey guys, I'm kind of on the edge right now, so... if you don't laugh, it might send me into a tailspin. I'll commit suicide. So if you hear the news report, recently, unknown comedian Jonah Ray who committed suicide, it's on you. It's on you. So just remember that tonight as we move forward.
If the audience wasn't familiar with you or your humor, they would really think that you literally... I'm always amazed at what people will take as... Like they would go... Wow, he really said he was going to kill himself. Yeah. I'm like, no, but it was in the context. Like, we always think everything's like, oh, no one could take any of this seriously. But people hear words and they go, that must be that.
Yeah, they do.
Even when paying money to enter a comedy club.
Yeah, well, you know, not always the case.
No. I was in Denver a couple of weeks ago and I did a show and a guy up front with his wife. And you could tell by his haircut that he wasn't going to like it. Because he had kind of that Lee Ermery, you know, Full Metal Jacket kind of DI hairdo. And I did a lot of politics. And I said that Bradley Manning, nay Chelsea Manning, had decided to get a sex change after being convicted and thrown in the federal joint for... I go, so in a military prison, you're going to get a sex change. I go, that is swinging a giant clit. And at that point, I could see him withdraw into a Nautilus-like shell, you know? So he has the temerity to sit through the whole goddamn show, and then he gets up with 4 minutes. You know, when you're just about to finish it up, you're like, okay, we're done here. Boom, he gets up and leaves. And I'm like, and then the guy next to him, I go, well, what was his problem? The guy's like, he's from Texas. I go, did he just generally announce that? Or did he go, no, he told me, you know? So I go outside after the show. If you played the Comedy Works in Denver.
One of my favorite clubs.
The little staircase out in the back. I go out in back, and there he fucking is. And he, hey, real funny, Mr. Fucking Funny. Yeah, run away. I'm like, do you actually think I'm going to go toe-to-toe with you on the street?
Right.
Because you disagreed with what I said on stage?
Like, right.
No, I'm not.
Now you're in my arena.
Oh, yeah.
The world!
Someone didn't inform him.
Yeah. My podcast, The Toughest Man in the World. Going toe-to-toe with a nerd.
His podcast, exactly. Yeah. I'll finish you off, Specky. Yeah. But I thought, if you hated the show so much, leave at the beginning. I have no problem. My ego's huge. I get it that everybody doesn't like me. Yeah. Don't leave 2 minutes from the end and then try to brace me on the street like Wyatt Earp and shit.
I'm calling you out.
You're fucking
hey, comic, man. I'm calling you out.
A real funny show. And I almost went like, well, you got some of the jokes. Therefore, it was probably funnier than anything you've been to recently, like, you know, a gang violation or a motorcycle rally or whatever the fuck it is you go to.
I do love that Comedy Works downtown. That is such a fucking great
club. It's a great club, and that was the only thing that happened the whole week that was a bummer. Everyone else was lovely, but how do they do it? They sit in the front, and then they find me after. Like, no, there's too many coincidences, you know.
I
hide in the back and then fuck off.
Yeah.
I don't think, I think it's just, I think it's all just accidental. They just show up at a certain time, they get sat there, they don't want to be part of the thing, and, you know, I'm like you in that. A lot of my set is chatty. I like to talk to people. It just makes the show fun for me. But I remember I was doing a show in where was I? In Wisconsin, I think, in Madison, which is also a great club. The club in Madison is really great too. And I, you know, I'm just talking to people in the front. And I put the microphone down, the guy in the front row, and he was, and he mumbled something. And I'm like, what? I'm sorry, I didn't hear what you said. And then I just see the gaze. And he's like, get the fucking microphone out of my face. And like, it was that moment where you just kind of felt for the second, just the room just go, and everyone was like, whoa. And if I had been any less experienced of a comic, the show would have been over in the first 4 minutes. Because the guy got up and then stormed out, and then people started booing him, and he was like, fuck you! Like that.
Oh, Jesus.
And I was just like, hey, you know, just let him go. Yeah. Don't leave him alone. Yeah. He's having a time, and don't fucking harass him, you know? And then just continue to do the show. It was fine.
Yeah.
And then afterwards, I saw him, and I was like, oh, boy, here we go. Uh-huh. It turns out the poor guy just had horrible, like, anxiety, like stage fright anxiety. He, you know, he apologized. I'm like, you don't have to apologize. It was totally fine, you know. As long as you're fine, the audience will be fine. But it definitely, that was one of those moments where I was like, ah, shit. It's fine. Talking to people in the audience is finally going to bite me in the ass.
Do I lay into this dude for being a dickwad, or do I just back the fuck off and let everybody live their lives?
I tend to not lay into people in an aggressive way. I'll sort of tease them and have fun to sort of test, like, how serious are they?
Yeah.
And then if it gets to a certain point where I'm like, oh, yeah, they're on the warpath, then a lot of times I will either just sort of be like, enjoy yourself. Yeah. You know, like, it's not worth...
No, it's not worth causing a riot in the club and destroying the crowd, because that's what it does. Then they start to pick sides, too. Like, if you're too mean to a heckler, then they're like, hey, he's one of us.
It is a really interesting balance. Just the awareness of, like, crowd dynamics that you have to understand on such a deep level without even thinking about it, so that... Because every show, what you forget about when you were doing comedy for a long time is that any show... has the potential to go horribly wrong in any minute that you're on stage out of nowhere.
One thing can drop them off.
Well, it's like if you're in a relationship, you know, everything can be fine. All of a sudden, someone can say something and then just dum, 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 dum. And then it's like, now we're fighting. And a minute ago, we were fighting. And I don't know how we got here.
Cut to, you're at the men's club. I guess I'll be here for a couple of days. Got your tennis racket.
Now I'm in touch with the wife.
Yeah.
You know what I still can't understand is, like, when there's those splits, there's those split halves where it's like you go and you say a joke, and for some reason, not that any of the, it's not like there's two groups of people that came together to the show, but one side of the room totally is cracking up, but for some reason the other side doesn't. I don't understand the science behind that.
You know, I'll tell you what I think it is. It's that it's sort of like, laughter is sort of like a zombie virus, right? So it'll start...
Tidbits of knowledge from Talking Dead host.
Our hashtag today is Michonne's Blade. But essentially, a crowd needs a handful of catalysts in any area to start the chain reaction.
Yeah.
And a lot of times it happens so fast that you can't really tell where it comes from. But I think, because I've thought about this a lot, one side of the room can have... a couple of people that sort of catalyze the reaction, and then on the other side,
it doesn't go that far.
It just doesn't It's like they're not. Mm-mm. They don't have a couple people on the far right side that are kicking the energy back to the center.
Yeah,
and so it does start kind of on the left side, and then just kind of peters out.
Yeah.
So I really do think it's a hand, because it's contagious. You know, like the laughter thing. Yeah. I think it has something to do with that. May not be right.
No, that seems about right. Well, figured it out. Thank you.
Nope. I just don't want to get a zombie virus from the crowd.
Well, that's where you would get it.
Yeah.
If you, the worst place to be would be in any type of performance venue.
Yeah,
when that shit hits.
You showed at CineFamily last Halloween season. I think it was
Return of the Living Dead. Dan O'Bannon.
Yeah, which is it's on my top five favorite zombie movies.
I agree. I think it's the bleakest of all the zombie movies in a hilarious way, because there's no way to beat them. They can't be killed. If you shoot them in the head, they don't care.
Yeah,
and nothing stops them, and at the end, the whole world ends. And you're like, wow, this was quite a little screenplay you got to here. There's no way to defeat them. At no point are they winning. At no point do the humans win.
You know how most movies, there's like this glimmer of hope?
No. Even in Night of the Living Dead, they're like, well, we might win.
Yeah. You know?
The police are at least on the case, you know? In this movie, send more cops, and then they just eat the cops.
And I love it, because it's just like, it's like the dumb fault of a couple of like idiots. It's like you never, in any other zombie movie, you never get to see like, who's the guy that fucked up. Right. Who's the guy that left the door open to, like, the virus room, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, I like just the two, and there's just two of the, like, that's such a funny performance, those
I
two guys.
I love them. And Clue Gallagher and James Karen are hilarious in it. And you've got 80s punks in it. You've got the naked, Linnea Quigley gets up and gets naked.
Yeah,
which
yeah.
Is like she's a hallmark naked again. Of any great B-80s movie.
And, like, it's a good line, too. It's like, get some light over here. She's getting naked again.
Yeah,
which,
she's
like,
getting naked
got
again.
Me so excited. I was like, I want to hang out with a girl that just gets naked all the time to where you have to say again.
Was Return of the Living Dead 84?
80, yeah, in there somewhere. Because there's a crappy sequel to it. There's Return of the Living Dead 2, but I don't think Hannah Bannon wrote it.
Yeah, there's actually a bunch of sequels, which is weird because the Diminishing Returns... well, no, there's just no returns. There's just like the second one is just
the world,
world
ends in the first one, so you're kind of like, well, it's like the end of the Matrix. The first Matrix, you're like, it's over now. He won, and then oh no, we're having a disco at Burning Man. And then the third one,
we're having an underground rave where everyone should really theoretically look like mole people.
Yeah, but
instead they look like the most sun healthy.
Yeah. Giant dreadlocks and lots of hair.
They basically set up in the first movie that like. Oh, yeah, the real world is really horrible.
Yeah.
And there's no, you know, like, we live underground, there's no, it just sucks. But then everyone's gorgeous.
Oh, yeah. Well, it has bitchin' outfits.
It's like Ibiza, you know?
But it's future society. So basically, like, I think if, like, every, like, when everyone's.
When all the fatties got weeded out, what happened?
It's just like, because it's like, you know, like, race is just going to not become a thing, and everyone's going to, and, like, just the amount of, you know, people that are, like, you know, brown or white, it's like, everyone's going to become olive and gorgeous.
I'm not talking about skin tone. I'm talking about everyone is, like, buff and ripped.
Exactly. Yeah. No, because like,
and they eat garbage. They show you what they eat.
Yeah,
it's disgusting. And you're like, well, how do you get
it's
so
enough
healthy
proteins?
On that?
All the body needs.
Yeah. But like, when everyone in the world starts to, like, you know, just procreate with all the different, you know, ethnicities
in a cave.
Exactly. It's just going to turn into the perfect human.
No,
it has to, right?
I think
it's going to be a worse version.
No. Everyone will turn into those creatures from The Descent. Is what'll happen.
No, just think about it. Think of like all the really hot people. You know, they're always like half Asian or half black or something like that. That's
fine.
Like
but if they were born and bred underground, I don't think
had to go to a disco with Jada Pinkett. Think of the punishing. That's why I like the H.G. Wells, the Time Machine one, because all the good-looking people live on the surface of the earth, and then it turns out they're just fodder for the other people
food.
Who live underground, and it's like, well, that seems about right.
Yeah.
Such a genius idea.
800,000 years in the future, everyone's blonde and gorgeous, and they're just rabbits for stew.
Yeah, just keep them happy. Keep them happy.
Give them oranges and whatnot.
Yeah, that's what we do with cows, right? Yeah. We just basically let them live these pleasure orgies until we surface to devour them.
Yeah. Hang out in the field, and then I'll be your Morlock.
Yeah, we just hung out and partied. I would fuck all the time. It was a good time being a cat.
Smash. My head. I don't feel that good.
What's happening?
That little thing from No Country for Old Men.
Right, the cat.
Oh, yeah. That's right.
Didn't want to get no blood on the car.
I got really sad after that movie because I had postpartum depression. Come on, Jonah, let's up top.
That's what I'm talking about.
Come on, you guys.
That's the best Cormac McCarthy. Well, one movie, but two, it's one of the better Coen Brothers movies because that's not a great book. It's an okay book. There's a lot of hashing around about death and stuff in it, but the movie has a sense of humor that they're able to bring to it, like when the dog is swimming after him. And there's a few scenes in the movie that I saw it in the theater, opened huge laughs.
Yeah.
And it's like, you need that in that movie because it's an unrelenting story of terror where one dude just will not stop or whatever.
They should have done that. They should have directed The Road as well.
The Road. I didn't even see The Road. I just couldn't. I mean, he's one of my favorite authors, but I just really feel like you can't do his movies. You know, there's too much in them, except for No Country, which there's not that much in, so it was perfect for a movie.
Yeah.
What's next for where are you performing now? Are you all over the country? Or
I am. I'm at the Bar Lubitsch next week on the 16th.
Bar Lubitsch!
Yeah. And then where am I? Then I'm at Bar Lubitsch on November 6th. I'm on the road with the Who's Line guys. I'm doing stand-up all over. I'll be in Calgary in November and Boston in November. And then I have a new stand-up special coming out on October 22nd. Called Greg Proops Live at Musso and Frank. I shot it over at Musso and Frank.
No way. Really?
Did you really?
Yeah.
Where?
Yeah.
Like how? Where?
On the floor of the back room in the restaurant. Man.
Fuck, that sounds awesome.
You know where the bar is in the back room?
I think so. I haven't been there in ages.
Right. Musso's has two areas. There's the one area with
there's
the Musso's counter.
And then there's Frank's.
And then there's Frank's, There's a counter, and then there's all the red booths. And then in the other room is the dining room. And that's where we did it in the dining room, where there's this beautiful bar with the mirror and everything. And Sergio was there, and you know, the cats, Ruben's worked there for 40 years.
Oh, my God.
Sergio's worked there for 35 years or something. They know the Stones. Like, the Stones bring them on gigs and stuff. Oh, they all have guitars from them and everything, because the Stones, evidently Keith eats there and when they're in town. And yeah, they tell me. I had him introduce me, and he got nowhere near my name, which was awesome. No, it was my manager's idea. It was really good. He'd been there for some event with one of the old Munchkins. I'm not kidding. And this is my favorite part of his story. He's like, I'm at this event, and this guy, this Munchkin's there, and he's 94. But he says he's 91, which I, you know, fantastic. And so we thought, well, let's shoot it there, because I'm old school, and it's an old school place. And then, like, oh, we're going to put a stage in and shit. I'm like, let's not. Let's just put a table in. So I had a little table, and I stood on the floor, and we put people in front of me, and we kind of shot it and put some smoke in the room. And it looks really bitchin'. It does
look bitchin'. That sounds great.
It's really fun.
Has the podcast gotten more people out than anything you've worked on before?
Yes, Chris, it has. It's been the most significant thing I've done in my – I think the funnest thing I've done in comedy in 30 years, you know. And I've been doing this since, you know, the earth was a swirling ball of methane, and the podcast gets more reaction and more people, and I can go all over the world with it and all over the country into different countries and stuff, and people come out, and it's fantastic. So I'm pumping the stand-up special off the back of the podcast too, but I never ask for money for the podcast, you know, like it's free, like
free, yeah.
It's like yours, like we all try to keep that on the
yeah,
the free end. So I don't feel bad asking for $5 for a comedy special.
No.
That you can download.
I think people understand that.
Yeah, they do, and that's what the hipness of the comedy crowd is now. That people understand that you're, you know, I'm not plugging everything every 2 seconds of my life, and I'm not making you pay for special editions where I'm in a cave or whatever, or a barrel.
Right.
So yeah, that comes out on the 22nd, and that'll be fun. It looks good, and I'm happy with it. I mean, you know, it's not very political. It's like a couple of. I talk about Hollywood a lot in the first part because everyone drank at Musso's. And apparently Chandler wrote The Big Sleep in a booth there.
Oh, wow.
And Faulkner used to drink and go behind the bar in that back room. And what's different about it now is in the old days, there was a doorman for the back room. So it was Valhalla. Like, if you were Chandler or John Fonte or Bukowski, yeah, you got to come in the back room. If you were a mortal, you were welcome to sit in the other room.
Wow.
And, you know, everybody ate there ever. Bogart, Chaplin. Chaplin's table's the one next to the window and stuff. When the windows opened onto the street, and he would kibitz with people. And evidently had a running gun argument about who would pay for lunch. Because he'd come there and eat every day. It opened in 1919. He'd come and eat every day there. And Musso would go, you know, here's your bill. And Chaplin would go, I'm bringing people in.
Oh. Wow.
And apparently he raced Douglas Fairbanks down the street on horseback, and the winner had to buy lunch and stuff. Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God.
You know, because his studio was over. His studio
was right down on
where the Muppets is.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, the old A&M studios, yeah. Too. The Chaplin studios.
That was
studios.
TriStar,
so
right?
You just went down right down Hollywood Boulevard, and there's Moose's over at the end.
Yeah, because they have little apartments there, too. Yeah. He had apartments. There's a scattering of Chaplin apartments.
Yeah, he has one right on the beach in Santa Monica, too, a house, right?
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Did he really?
Yeah, wow. I think so.
There was some on Sweetser, and I used to live on Sweetser in West Hollywood, yeah. And across the street there was a little collection of Chaplin cottages.
Chaplin
little bungalows.
Yeah.
No, he got around town. Well, I mean, imagine in 1919, he was probably the biggest star in the world. Yeah. Him, Fairbanks, Pickford, and who else? That would be it.
I don't know.
Who else started United Artists? I'm missing somebody in there. But
probably a couple horses.
A director, yeah. And a horse. Yeah. Rex the Wonder Horse.
Yeah. Who also got to come in the back.
Yeah. You see, like, video from the old days, they'll have Chaplin lookalike contests, and there'll be thousands of kids dressed like Chaplin, or him in the middle of a crowd of people, and it's like Babe Ruth, you know, just a sea of people and Chaplin and everybody doing him, and, you know, like, there was no one more recognizable, I don't think, on Earth. Because, of course, he didn't have to speak any other languages. With the silent pictures, your pictures just went everywhere.
And also just being at the dawn of a whole new experience that was unlike anything that had existed before. I mean, unlike anything.
To see
moving pictures.
You know, we take it for granted. But to all of a sudden, you know, like a week ago, you had never heard of this thing. And then, wait, I can see projected and it's moving. The pictures are moving, you know.
Yeah. And on location, because he was, you know, he's a great filmmaker. The Gold Rush is shot up in the mountains. He moved stuff around.
Yeah, and like,
he didn't just shoot in a studio.
Yeah, and to be like a guy who was like pushing the medium itself right away.
Oh, yeah.
Like, just like, you know, wasn't just like relegating it to just being like, we'll just do a story of a love, you know, lost or something in the studio. Like, they go out and they have like, you know, all these locations. It was...
And he improvised, evidently. He they did hundreds of takes, whereas Keaton was much more meticulous, I think. Keaton planned everything out and was more, you know, thoughtful about every single shot. And I think Chaplin would run the same scene 50 times and then use the best take. Like, we're going to do the scene over and over and over and over. Because you see on his, you know, call sheets, they do one scene all day, you know, for days and days until they got the scene they wanted. But he had that kind of leeway at that point since he owned his own company. So he could kind of go like, well, we're just going to work on this till it's done. I mean, I don't think when the two-wheelers, the early ones that he did was Senate. And where was Senate Studio? It was out in the valley?
I don't know.
Keystone, right? When he lived in a water tower and he nailed all the girls, the bathing beauties, and he sent it laid in a bathtub, and that's how he got his ideas and everything. And so he hired Chaplin first, and so the real early shorts that are with Keystone and Mutual and all that are like really funny. As my friend Paul Merton, the comedian, said, when he's about hunger, that's when he's the funniest. Because my wife doesn't like, I don't know about you, you know, no one even watches Chaplin anymore, but I mean, having said that, yes, people watch Chaplin. Don't fucking phone. don't fucking email me and
apologies.
Don't call Chris and go, you had Proops on, and Proops said no one watched Chaplin, and I watched a Chaplin movie 2 years ago, and I thought it was amusing.
Okay. Apologies to everybody who's watched a Chaplin movie ever.
So let's just blanketly say, I'm sorry for everything.
Yeah, I'm sorry for everything I've ever asserted. But when the movies got bigger and he did the features, those are really funny, but... The two-wheelers that are 10 minutes long when he's stealing food off tables, that's when he's the funniest, when he's a starving poor person. Because it's always the big guy with the beard or the cop coming down the street and him, you know, and then boom, he gets hit in the head, you know, or he has to run around. And like, that's when the need. And I think that's also spoke to that crowd then. We're talking about first-generation Americans and second-generation people watching. You know, what you made one called The Immigrant, one called Easy Street, where it's always people moving into a ghetto and they're poor and the people who were going paid a nickel in those days. And, you know, like, that's, I think, the beauty of the connection that they made. Because it's so sentimental and it's so Victorian. There's always a blind girl. There's always a kid. Yeah. You know, that's stuff you would never do now. Shameless stuff, you know. Yeah. And Keaton's not. Keaton's real modern. And Harold Lloyd, too. Harold Lloyd's a middle-class guy. And Keaton's always, you know, I'm just... Po-faced, does nothing rings me. I don't have a little kid that I kiss, you know.
Yeah.
Well, taking it back to, it's sort of bringing it back around to some part of the earlier conversation, my girlfriend had never seen Benny and June, so she brought it up the other day. And I remember liking it when I first saw it, but I also, when I was explaining it to her, I'm like, okay, it's a fine movie for what it is, but it is... Like, you will almost drown in the preciousness of, like...
Who's the girl in that one? I can't remember.
Catherine... No. Oh, fuck! Mary...
It's Johnny Depp and...
Mary... She has three names.
Mary Beth Hurt, Mary Elizabeth...
It's not Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio. She was in The Abyss. It was...
And Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves.
Oh, yeah.
Wearing a bag of measly on her head.
Boy, I'm really disappointed in myself because usually
Don't be... To be honest, I don't think I've seen all of Benny and June. I always confuse it with Gilbert Grape, but Gilbert Grape's...
Mary Stuart Masterson! Oh, man. She gave birth to a brain baby.
Was it Johnny Depp?
And the whole...
That's why I confuse it with Gilbert Grape.
You know, she was disturbed. She was a disturbed young girl, and Aidan Quinn was her older brother who had to take care of her, and he's just a mechanic. Yeah. And then here comes Johnny Depp, who is a caregiver, and they fall in love, but she's a, you know, like the first scene of him... He's reading a book that says, like, the look of Buster Keaton. And he looks like Buster Keaton. And the first time she sees him, he's in a tree. And it's just like that kind of like, okay. You know, I mean.
Is he wearing the straw hat?
Well, he's got a little hat on.
Yeah.
And for that type of movie, it is an adorable movie. It's a well-done version of that movie. Yeah. But just a wave of preciousness. We're like, I need to
Is that
to
where
come
the Proclaimers movie came?
Yes. Yes.
And when I'm walking, I knew I'm going to be.
I'm going to be the man who's walking up to you. Right. When I'm podcasting, well, you know I'm going to be. I'm going to be the man who's podcasting with you.
500 episodes?
And I'm going to do this 500 times.
Yeah.
And when you're Greg Proops.
And you're Proopin' going to be. You know I'm going to be the man who's Proopin' over you.
when you're Jonah. I'm just going to keep it going.
In the 90s, when I used to tour in England, that was my opening line. Good evening. I am the Proclaimers.
Oh, my God, of course. Of course,
I wear specs. I'm specky, man.
Yeah, you got the.
And when you played Scotland, man, kaboom, kaboom, Hiroshima.
What does it do? The song?
Yeah.
No, I was kidding.
Yeah, not really, I'm not. Yeah. I'm missing my brother.
Do the song.
Yeah.
When I.
No, and I don't even know where they're from. They're from outside of Edinburgh or something. I remember my wife saw them in the. A long time ago in San Francisco, and the whole crowd was Scottish, and Scottish flags were produced.
Whoa.
During the show. Oh, fuck yeah. Because they're very marchy, aren't they? You know?
Yes.
Absolutely. Yeah. Does your set change at all between here and across the pond?
Yeah, I'll talk about more English politics and stuff like that. But no, the last time I was over there in August at Edinburgh, I hammered on America a lot more. And I was, you know, it's a tough year for Black Jesus. Plus, the week I was there... it was when Snowden got deported. When Bradley Manning got incarcerated. So I was talking about all that stuff more than English politics. When I'd been there in the summer before, there'd been a lot more England. And when Occupy was going on, because Occupy in England was a big, you know, church at St. Paul's, right? And the head priest or minister, whatever, St. Paul's, wasn't having it, right? Because there was too many poor people shitting and pissing around his fabulous church, which, of course, I think you'll find that the poor are supposed to be welcome at your church.
Yeah, yeah.
And it turned out he was taking a private car there every day and jets and, you know, yeah. And he really laid down the law. And so when they knocked that encampment down, so I had to go at him, you know. And then I find out, you know, not everybody was on the Occupy tip, you know.
Oh, really?
A guy came to review that show. That was like a year or a half, whenever Occupy was happening, but 2 years ago, right? And I did that whole bit, and he didn't like it. I think it was the Times critic or something. And then at the end, I did this bit about Ireland, where I just make fun of Ireland for 10 minutes. And it's, you know, reasonably hacky, but amusing. And, you know, I was going to the Irish, the Ireland doesn't have a navy, you guys. They're an island, you know. How lazy, you know, that kind of. And the review's like, this show is bullshit. It was nonsense. I hated it. Then he started in on some great Irish material. Now I have to take that out, you know. Like, as soon as I got racist, he lit up, you know.
Oh, man.
Yeah, about those fucking Irish. Oh, he's coming over here and whatnot.
Finally,
you know,
someone's selling it like it is.
Yeah, exactly. But the whole hour before about how the government... Because, you know, they had the giant riots, right, in London. And Michael Sheen, their prime minister, was David Cameron was gone, and Boris was gone, the mayor of London. And I remember being with my wife and driving in the car and listening to like the BBC World Service. And the riot had been going for 4 days. It had started on Thursday, and we were listening on a Sunday in the news. And the reporter actually said on the news, Boris Johnson and David Cameron have rushed back to London to be part. And I went, whoa, rush back? I go, they were in Italy. That's a 2-hour plane ride. It's been 4 days. The country's on fire. I'm calling friends there, and they're like, yeah, down the street from our house, there's fucking houses are getting knocked over. Oh, yeah. You know, Jeez. It was a fucking giant riot in London. And like, I was like, rushed back? Really? Our definition of rush is a little different.
But at the very last minute, when they got over, they were very, you know.
It was horrible. And then, of course, they arrested all the kids, the ones who were using Facebook and stuff. A bunch of them got put in jail. And sort of ignoring the fact that, well, the riot didn't happen because of Facebook. The riot happened because there's poor people who were kind of fucking angry. And blah, blah, blah. But that's a harder comedy sell, as you know, especially to critics who love that Irish material.
They love it.
I do.
They want to hear it. That's all they want. If he just stuck to that.
If I could just... Well, I don't come to learn. This isn't CNN. Can't you talk about something fun? What about your cock? Surely that's an endless cornucopia of humor.
Farts are funny. What if your cock could fart? Do something with that.
Yeah. You spin that around. Yeah. If my cock was Irish, it'd be Greg O'Proop's cock.
Yeah, he's doing it. Yeah. That's what I'm talking about.
Exactly.
Yeah, and it'd never get hard.
Hello. It'd be like a peat bog.
Nice.
Yeah. So yes, I changed the material here and there for there, but not to the point where I worry about it too much. I mean, when guys go over there, I always say to them, you've been over there, I've seen you over there. People go, well, should I change my material for England? I'm like, you have jokes, right? And they go, yeah. And I'm like, tell those. Tell your jokes. If they're not the most arcane American joke in the world, if you're not talking about going to, you know, Dothan, Alabama to a Waffle House or something, then you'll probably get away with it. And even then, they'll understand the concept of it way more than Americans would if you said, I was pushing a pram on the pavement and blah, 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 you know. Because, well, Americans can't translate anything.
Yeah.
My old, my older set, like two sets ago, I realized was almost all America pop culture centric. Mm-hmm. And I realized it when I went to Canada. I think it was one of the first times I ever did Just for Laughs. And I was struggling, and I realized, like, oh, these are all, this is all our culture.
A bit site-specific.
Yeah. They weren't people jokes. They were, like, America jokes.
Yeah, I was just in Canada, and you have to open it up a little. But, I mean, I'm there a lot, so I know more. I read the paper. People go, how do you know so much about Canadian culture? It's like, well, I read the paper today.
And anyone can. You can just pick it up.
Pretty much.
And then you got
find out who the prime minister is.
You can't
right
find
away.
A newspaper. Just go to .ca, and you got your covered.
Pretty much. Yeah. It's all there.
That's
all you got. That's
all you got to do.
You know, Americans, we're always like, well, aren't we just the center of the world and shit? And then you go other places, and you're like, no, not actually.
No.
You can talk about show business for a few minutes. And then that's the end of that. Their entertainment level on that kind of wanes, you know, inversely proportional. I'm sure there's some theorem. The more Kim Kardashian jokes you throw in, the less the humor slides down a certain.
Yeah, unfortunately, I think what can happen is we are kind of, because we're so big, like, so we're just geographically large, and we're so focused on America at all times, and we're kind of isolated from the rest of the world.
Yeah, by long plane rides.
Yeah, that essentially we do kind of have the spoiled kid syndrome. We're like, oh, we think it's about, like, we're kind of like only children.
It's us, right?
Yeah, and then
what about me and my needs?
Yeah, exactly.
I'm cool.
I mean, we think we're like the young cool kid at the party, but actually, what everyone else sees is like the 42-year-old kid guy at the frat party who's still like, man, we're gonna fucking tear this up, and all the
kids
are like, can you not be here?
Yeah, you didn't know anything about anywhere else. Well, that's the good thing about doing the podcast in different countries is I have to talk about where I am, and so I have to learn something about where I am, and so I'll talk about Canadian politics or English politics or Irish politics or whatever, and I think they like it because, one, they don't expect an American to fucking know a goddamn thing about it, and two, no matter how ill-informed my opinion is, at least I've made this – it's like saying bonjour in France. They're like, thank you.
That's adorable. That
it's
is
nice
adorable.
That you did it. Yeah. You know where Ottawa is. Good for you, Greg. You know what Ottawa is. Hooray. You know we have a parliament.
but that said, one of my favorite things about being a comic is getting to see so much of our country that most people will never, ever, ever
like
see.
Like Bloomington, Indiana.
Like Bloomington, Indiana is the. I was just thinking of Bloomington, Indiana. I would never think that's a place I should go. And then you realize, like, that is a cultural. There's a mecca of. I mean. You know, have you been to Comedy Attic?
Madison,
in
Wisconsin, and Indiana.
Yeah. No, I've been there when I was in bands, and there's like there's a huge music scene there. It's like a lot.
Sure.
Of
it's a great.
What's that huge university there? IU?
It's the University of Indiana. Yeah, it's right there.
Well, those are the guys that tried to take down the Cutters, but the locals are the ones that won the race.
Hello.
Yeah.
Is that your favorite movie, Breaking Away?
Breaking Away is one of my favorite movies. Yeah.
Right. Did you do a little Dennis Quaid? Which Quaid was it?
That was Dennis Quaid,
right? The
hunky
one. Yeah.
Yes.
It wasn't Randy. Yeah.
That was the first time. Yeah.
No, I don't think anyone looks at Randy and goes, he's a cyclist. I bet he rides bikes.
He's a cyclist of some kind. No, I know. And the reason I went to Bloomington was because of you. I got offered the club there. And the first thing you do, you know, when they go, do you want to play this place? I'm sure you guys do it.
You ask people.
You ask other comics, you know, and you go to the website to see who they've got. And if it's Shackley Schlecklenburg, you're like, you know, Making Fun of Mexicans Night on Wednesdays or whatever. You're like, oh, that's not going to be good. I shouldn't go there.
But then when you see, like,
it was
Bamford,
you and Doug Benson.
It's like
Chris Hardwick and Doug Benson doing their podcast live. And I was like,
oh,
I'm going
so
there
much
and
fun.
Doing my podcast live because Doug Benson and Chris Hardwick did
it live. We had some of the best Afghani food.
That one little street.
Yes,
there's one street,
and it has all these. It has all this international cuisine, but like authentic internet, and it's fucking great.
I know. Yeah. I had marvelous Thai food in Bloomington, and you think, how does that happen?
Bloomington's. Yeah. Well, the formula is whenever you have a massive university.
Yeah.
It's the same thing with Madison. It's the same thing with Austin. It's the same thing with Bloomington.
Or Northampton, Mass.
Yeah, when you have a massive university right there, it just infuses this young artistic culture. Their culture. It's a bring a culture.
Yeah.
There's going to be record stores. There's going to be lesbians.
There's going to be international.
Right.
There's
going to be lefties. There's going to be a lefty newspaper.
There's going to be...
All the things that Indianapolis doesn't have.
Because a university that size, which has 30,000 or 40,000 people, will also draw an international crowd. And guess what? International people bring wonderful parts of their own culture.
Yeah.
Like the chow.
Yeah.
It's fantastic that it's this one street and they're so proud of it because there's several Tibetan places, Afghani. Like, it's not just Italian and, French or whatever. They went around to the Caucasus and
I'm not even sure if I could tell you an Afghani place in Los Angeles, but Bloomington, I know exactly where it is.
I could take you to Little Ethiopia.
Which I love.
Yeah.
We eat the shit out of Ethiopia. We've been to Ethiopian restaurants in pretty much every city. We try to find, and the only reason we didn't eat Ethiopian in Bloomington is because we found the Afghani place. But so fantastic.
Yeah.
It's good. The Ethiopian food is. It is the one time where I feel bad about not finishing everything. Though. So they come over and you're like, I'm sorry,
I'm full.
Yeah. No, I'm American. We waste things. Yeah, yeah. I order more than I need because it's fun, and then I don't know.
Yeah. Right. And there's a lot of paper products with everything, so we can just throw.
Do you want to take this home? No, I don't.
I used to go there. There was one on Fairfax, Little Ethiopia, that was like an all-you-can-eat buffet, and it was like $5. So I used to, like, when I was broke, I would go down there and just fucking have it.
Put it on.
Well, there's Roslyn's, which is really good because they have the yam balls that are really good. There's another one across the street.
I had that, but it went away. Good night, everybody.
Hey!
See you in the corner. Noodling.
Oh, now do the Irish jokes. But they're really there's another place called Meals by Gannett or Gannet. It's a little bit of a snazzier restaurant, but phenomenal.
Yeah.
Because you're spoiled for choice in a city like San Francisco or Los Angeles or New York. There's going to be Ethiopian places and Armenian places and this and that. You go to Indiana and it's TJ Friday and Ruby Tuesday and lots of bar food and lots of cheese on everything, and then you get to Bloomington and you're like, oh, I can have noodles.
This thing is green. There's green on this place.
Yeah. Chopsticks.
and the Italian restaurant's not. What's that one that's at Maggiano's? Or there's always the chain or P.F. Chang's.
Yeah.
If you see
the Macaroni Grill.
The Macaroni. Yeah. I ate it in Niagara Falls, and it was the saddest Italian food ever. So sad. And when did cheddar cheese get introduced to Italian cuisine?
when it came to the Midwest.
Oh, buddy. It's just so sad, the food. I totally judge everything based on my personal comfort and what kind of food's there. There's a place called Ana Cortez, Washington, and we play a casino outside of it. And you would think, oh, God, where is it? It's at the very, very top of Washington. It's quite near Canada. The food is to die. And there's seafood there. And, like, there's this place called the Adrift Bar, and I mean, every time we play there, I'm like, oh, I'm so excited to go to this tiny
Well, because hotel. When you're on the road a lot, that's what that, those are the kind of things where you get enjoyment. Oh,
scallops.
That place has those bagels that are really where you get that's where you get your enjoyment.
Because when you go to Chicago, you're going to go, oh, I'm going to go to that place that I love. Yeah. Or, in Texas, I'm going to go to that barbecue place that I
Well, that's what I'm saying. It's like you would not know that if you didn't travel around this country. Some of the best Italian food I've ever had was in the the peninsula of Michigan.
Oh, the UP?
The Upper Peninsula, yeah.
Were you playing Marquette?
Maybe. Yeah. I can't remember. It was a college right on a river.
Yeah.
It was wintertime. It was gorgeous there. Cold as fucking balls.
Yeah.
But there was an Italian restaurant, and Mike Furman and I just kind of wandered in there, and it turned out it was a couple who – it was an Italian couple who had lived in New York, and they just got sick of New York, so they moved – and it was some of the best Italian food I've ever had in the fucking Upper Peninsula of Michigan, where everything else just sort of felt like, oh, this is kind of an industrial town, and it'll probably just be some regular mom and pop stuff, but it was incredible,
right? And you want to cry sometimes because you're like, we found a place.
You never would have found. Like, I'm so happy to be like a tourist of our own country.
It's as long as I don't have to go to Pizza Hut when that's it. When it's like, well, the Steak and Shake's open. And you're like,
I don't want to go there.
It's breakfast time. I
had a hard time finding open places in San Francisco this weekend that are open late.
San Francisco's not a late eating place for some reason. You got to go to Chinatown and
well,
especially not
and roll the dice.
Especially
went to a place called Vietnam that was open real late, which was great. Most disgusting place I've ever eaten.
Right.
But like probably the best banh mi sandwich.
The problem is that you are the punchline is in the financial district, which is a not a nocturnal part of the country. I mean, no, the city.
Immediately. It becomes downtown LA.
Ghost town.
There's basically like I think even like the Elephant and Castle pub closes at midnight.
It closes.
Nothing is open there. Nothing. Near there. You have to go to North Beach or Chinatown, or you must leave the financial district because it's just
Uber.
That's
to the rescue.
I did that a bunch. Call Uber. Went to like a Korean diner one night with the worst mistake I made, but fucking best mistake I made.
There's a hideous hamburger stand. You know where Broadway and Columbus is? Tosca, which they've closed now, but Specs and City Lights and all that little corner.
Tosca, they just reopened.
Right. Tosca is a restaurant now, right?
Yeah.
It was, but they've, what's her name? Jeanette lost the.
Yeah.
It needed to change hands. If I had to sit in one more cracked fucking booth in that place for the. In any case, up the street there, there's an inconceivably revolting hamburger stand that has the best french fries in the world.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. Like, you go in and there's a dude with a sandwich for a head and, you know, the guy behind the counter. You know what I mean? Like, you're like, what happened here? What kind of genetic fucking horror? And then, but you know,
this is
if you're
fucking
drinking over there. You
BioShock
fries up there and a burger, the greasiest burger in the world. You know, there's a dude behind the counter. You know,
look at all these splicers in here. They've been juicing
that
on the atom.
Open all the goddamn time. I don't think it's ever fucking closed. You know, I was surprised. I was just in Toronto and there was everything open way late at night. I did a gig on a Sunday night and I go back to my hotel, which was, you know, like a corporate hotel. There was a hot dog stand open in front, and I go to the guy. You're kind of open late on a Sunday, and he goes. It's Toronto, not Somalia. Yes, we're open 24 hours. What? And I'm like, who gets a hot dog at 4:45 a.m.?
By the way, by the way, did he have to jump right to Somalia?
Yeah, like, no,
he could have just said, you know, we're not Lincoln, Nebraska.
Oh, right.
He was from Somalia.
Oh, okay,
he does that to everything.
I thought that was hilarious that he did jump right to Somalia. And they weren't just sitting on a thing. He put them on a grill and grilled the fucker and grilled the bun and everything.
Oh,
I was
nice.
Like, You know, it was the end of the night. I was starving. I was like, hell yeah. I would never eat a hot dog off a stand. But in Toronto, I was like, it's Toronto. Nothing. Yeah. And there was dueling ones, which I thought was hilarious. There was one like 20 yards past him.
Oh, funny.
And you're like, you guys are next to each other here. What's the difference?
Did he tell you it wasn't Somalia?
We think this is not like Ethiopia.
And then a bunch of pirates come up and take the hot dog. Fuck, it's just like Somalia.
Right. I got up and down with a 50.
I remember drinking at a bunch of bars in like Hollywood, and like, you know, last call, and you walk out, and then there's just like five different hot dog stands.
Yeah.
Just the carts, the LA cart where they wrap it in bacon and they have the
those
jalapeno
good.
And the grilled onions and everything on the side.
That I approve of. I remember being in Texas years ago doing some hideous gig for Comedy Central, and we were at some giant bar in Irving or some unspeakable place. But I remember being very drunk and coming outside, and there was a barbecue truck. And, you know, there's nothing like it, you know. Like, you just put it on your head. You don't even eat it. Just rub it on yourself. Wow.
You just absorb it through
Like, that's the perfect drunk food, right? Like, certain things are. And in Cleveland, a falafel stand, I remember, on one of those little streets near the, you know, the Hilarities in Cleveland.
Yeah.
Two streets over where all the people drink into those douchebag bars. Remember, there was a falafel stand open in the middle of the night, and I was like, yes!
I
don't have to go to Denny's.
I've never performed.
I'm getting a falafel from the guy, from the Armenian guy.
I did the colleges. I did the colleges in Ohio, Columbus and Cleveland. I did the... what's it called? It's technically not in Cincinnati. It's in northern Kentucky.
Oh, Lexington? No.
Lexington's
across the river from another...
It was a chain.
That's West Virginia, I'm thinking.
It was a comedy club chain.
Yeah.
It had a name like Yuck Yucks.
I was going to say it's not Yuck Yucks, but it's like that. Yeah, Laughs or something.
I can't remember. Anyway, that was in northern Kentucky in Cincinnati. But is Cincinnati? But
only the river separated them.
They were just, but culturally, miles away. And I say that being, I'm from Kentucky. I was born in Louisville, which you know because I say Louisville and not Louisville.
Yeah, Louisville.
I think that's about our hour, Proopsie.
All right.
An hour. That was we just did.
Well, happy Columbus Day to everybody.
Yeah.
Speaking of Columbus, Ohio.
Uh huh.
Now we just brought it back around.
Named for him. Here's one fact I'll drop on you about Columbus. The boats didn't not all the boats had decks that he took across the ocean. They gave him the three shittiest caravels they could fucking rustle up. He had been begging for 7 years or 8 years, and he'd already gone to the King of Portugal, and the King of Portugal told him to fuck off. He'd also gone to England, and they went fuck off. So he finally had been, you know, petitioning Isabel and Ferdinand. Ferdinand didn't care for him, but Isabel had a soft spot for the admiral. And so they signed the deal before the first trip, and they gave him these three shitty caravels. The Santa Maria ran aground when they were there, and he left a bunch of guys on the first journey. Oh, yeah, he did. From his crew, left them in the Caribbean, went back to Spain, barely got back, finally got back, landed in Portugal, had to make his way to Spain, but had with him a bunch of Indians that he'd stolen, a bunch of poor Arawaks or whatever. So when the queen and the king saw these fucking Indians, who they put clothes on because they were naked as the day they were born, and they brought parrots and shit like that and a few things, they were like, okay, go back. And the next voyage they gave him, 1,600 men, a shitload of boats, horses, the whole enchilada. So they went back like a year later. All the guys were dead.
Oh, shit.
So he left about 40, 50 guys from his crew on the first trip and just, we'll be back for you.
Oh.
Mind you, this is a place no one knew existed.
Yeah.
Right? So the faith that you have to have, like, we've taken this trip across.
Yeah, I'm sure he'll find this place again.
Yeah, and the three crappy boats full of woodworms and fucking eating salt pork off the thing. And they're like, we'll be back. Trust me. Oh, Columbus, I made it over. We're coming back, baby, and this time we're bringing wine.
Hey, we're ship's crew. We're not fucking survivalists.
Yeah. Like, yeah.
The Indians wiped them all out because immediately they, you know, tried some shit and that was the end of that.
We are from you. Bam.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Foop.
But no one ever tells you that part of the fucking story.
Yep.
Well, you just did.
Yep. Well, I thought I would.
They enjoyed. They did. That was not a burrito that they enjoyed.
It wasn't.
See, I was trying to take it around at the end.
Own it and just do it.
Enjoy. Enjoy your burrito, Mr. Columbus.
I don't know if you understand the concept of owning anything.
Mr. Columbus, may I borrow this? Can I borrow a feeling?
Yeah.
Thanks again, pal.
Enjoy your burrito. Oh, Proopsie, your special is available on, would we say VOD, video on demand?
Well, thank you for asking. It's chill.com/proops, or you can go to gregproops.com and click on the big banner that has my picture on it, and then you will be available to buy this special for $5.99 and all that.
A very special special.
It's a very special, special shot. The only comedy special ever shot at Musso and Frank's restaurant. That's on Hollywood Boulevard.
That we are aware of. Maybe yeah, they shot some stuff in the Chaplin times.
I was going to say, Chaplin probably did a hilarious short there with rolls and whatnot.
Yeah. And also the Smartest Man in the World podcast available on wherever podcasts are sold.
Yes, exactly. For no money.
For no money. So stop complaining.
Exactly. Do people do that with you? People write in and go, you should talk about this, and I'll write back, the show's free. How about you talk about what you want to talk about, and I'll handle my end.
Yeah, that argument's wearing thin on people. I've tried that a few times, and they're like, my time is the same as... I'm like, okay, all right.
Listen, you're driving. Let's be honest. Yeah. You're on a train, okay?
Yeah.
That's what you're doing.
You're not in a fucking barrel being pushed over to Niagara Falls to get the podcast.
This podcast isn't coming in. I wish the content was different as I toppled heedlessly over this precipice.
I don't know. I respect all the listeners a lot, so... Yeah, I'll do whatever they say.
Oh, you fucking son of a bitch. Yeah, yeah. Get back here!
Brown.
How dare you say that and try to pull away?
Brown, yeah, sir.
Get back here! No one can see you spinning in the other direction and holding your position.
I don't do everything for the podcast.
What?
Sometimes it's just for you guys in the room.
Oh.
That hilarious bit of
good
physical
idea.
Comedy.
That's right. Do it one more time.
No.
Well, now I'm the audience, and I'm telling you what to do. And if you respect the audience, then transitively you should respect what I'm saying.
Hey, I spent 30 seconds downloading your show this morning. Don't you think you owe me something?
Yeah, seriously, Jonah.
I don't have it automatic.
Wow.
Let's see how long a staring contest works on a podcast.
Is it a plank or a laugh contest? Because I just won both.
Wow.
I never realized how funny your face is.
Yeah. Real furry.
It's really furry. All right. We stopped ages ago.
Yeah, we did.
It gets really avant-garde at the end.
Do we throw down at the end?
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito. This episode of the Nerdist Podcast is brought to you by Stamps.com. Go to Stamps.com, click on the radio microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in Nerdist for a $110 bonus offer, including a digital scale and $55 of free postage. That's Stamps.com. Enter the promo code Nerdist.